the fast pace of technology, you really have to come up with a more agile, more faster pace of governance. And I said governance, not necessarily government. I think it's more includes government policy regulations, but it's more than that.
That's Ziyong Fang, a San Francisco-based tech lawyer and policy advocate with the World Economic Forum. He's point man on a project to determine the economic impact of digital trade and cross-border data flows. Prior to this, he served as senior legal counsel at Airbnb in Asia. Having worked in both public and private sector, Ziyong is uniquely qualified to comment on digital trade and just why governments around the world are up in arms with companies like Amazon, Netflix, and Uber. Most listeners will be familiar with our probing for that place where tech, policy, and society commingle, and more often than not, clash. It probably won't come as a surprise to learn that the world over, policy is having a hard time keeping pace with technology. It's not just governments that are struggling. Companies of all kinds are scrambling to keep pace with a tsunami of technological breakthroughs that in some cases threaten to eradicate businesses operating for eons. Governments and corporations alike can see the shadow of blockchain, AI, and data analytics in the rearview mirror, but lack a clear idea of exactly what to do about it. It's exactly this set of concerns, this reality, that led the World Economic Forum, or WEF, to establish the Center for the Fourth Industrial Revolution. I asked Ziyong to start there, to explain how the center got started, its goals and objectives.
The center was established in spring of last year, so spring 2017. And the whole idea is just that there's a gap between technology and the policy. And the current policies and regulations. As I mentioned, folks in the government, they don't quite understand technology and implications. On the other side, people working in the private sector, especially in tech sector, also feel that they need to engage. You know, even 5 years ago, if you ask a lot of the tech companies in the Valley, they will say, oh, we're just a platform, we're just a software company, we don't engage in policy making. But in the past couple of years, especially in the past year, you will see that there has been a lot of coverage, both positive and negative, on the technology, tech companies, and impact on society, from, you know, the Facebook election issue to large search engines, data privacy, and security issues. So all those issues are affecting everyone's life, and tech companies realize that they need to engage, need to be proactive and work with the government. And that's why the World Economic Forum established the Center for the Fourth Industrial Revolution, and using multi-stakeholder process to co-design policies maximize the benefits of technology and minimize the harm. Sorry.
Ziyong, is this because governments are feeling increasingly threatened by the impositions of technology? Are they starting to look now and say, we actually, whether it's blockchain or Bitcoin or trade, cross-border digital trade, we actually have an issue now. We're not sure how to contend with it. And therefore, technology is becoming part of the governmental policy issue, but also at a global level. Is it more of a threat or an opportunity that's driving the development and the initiatives at the center?
Yeah, I think it's both. I won't call it directly as a threat. Now, governments realize this is a major issue, and they want to use technology. I mean, technology has two sides. It can, for example, for developing countries, technologies can help you leapfrog, right, and get ahead in many issues. But at the same time, the implications of technology, you know, for example, with AI and robotics, which would lead to possibly lots of jobs. Especially based in Asia, you know, in Asia we talk about Factory Asia for decades, right? And that model has lifted many countries out of poverty and led to a pretty clear path to development. However, with robotics, with 3D printing, right? If we really get to that point, whereas developed countries can just print everything in their home country, what would that lead to for the developing countries? So I think if technology obviously has both sides, I think for governments, it's just trying to figure out how to deal with it, how to deal with the implications of the technology.
Yeah, fair enough. And even look in recent weeks where governments are starting to make outward statements about cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin and trying to push down the value or the usage of those of that type of cryptocurrency because they believe in fact it does, it violates sovereignty to some degree. Wouldn't that be correct?
Yeah, I think Steve, that's an excellent example. With the blockchain, we talked a lot of blockchain folks here in the Silicon Valley. If you say really, one, I think it's being a buzzword, right? There's a joke around here. If you have a problem, just use blockchain, right? I think there's a lot of obviously misunderstanding or rudimentary understanding what blockchain can do. At the same time, true blockchain with the distributed ledger technology can really help to revolutionize a lot of industries. I think, for example, in China, the government is also trying to grappling how to deal with this issue. You probably know last fall they first issued a policy that would ban cryptocurrency. But then a couple of weeks later after that initial policy, they issued another policy that would actually encourage the development of blockchain technology. So that's an indication that Chinese government is trying to distinguish from crypto, which is more hype, as you said, from the underlying technology, which is blockchain, which can help many industries. So that's a perfect example of government, because of this technology is so new, they're trying to keep up and also trying to crack course as they learn. So we're all kind of, making a plan as we fly when it comes to new technology.
All right. Interesting. So tell us, you were in Davos and you've just come away from the annual World Economic Forum event there. How large did technology figure in the key issues for executives and policymakers that attended that event?
Maybe I, because I'm a tech lawyer and policy advocate, maybe I have the tinted glasses on, but I saw tech played a huge role in this year's Davos. Of course, other themes were very present. The theme of this year is called creating a shared future in a fractured world. So geopolitical issues such as globalization, climate, equality, all those played an important role and dominated a lot of discussions. But for me, I think tech was no doubt. Give you an example, as soon as you walk into the main Congress Hall, which is where Davos takes place, there are a couple exhibitions before you even get to any sessions. And those are, exhibitions to demonstrate technology and art. To give you an example, the first one you see is this AI Holocaust survivor.
An AI Holocaust survivor. All right. Tell us about that.
Yes. So you imagine you walk into a screen. There is a gentleman, older gentleman, sitting on the chair. And you press the button, and you can have a conversation with him. So, and you can ask where he's from, what he does, what was the experience during the Holocaust, everything. And he will carry on the conversation with you.
He's a cyborg. He's not a real human being. It's just, it's a robot.
It's a TV screen.
Okay.
TV screen. And what they did was that, it's a real gentleman, and they interviewed him. They asked him thousands of questions. And then use the AI algorithm and with the program so that whatever question you ask, the system will match with a similar question that has been asked to him in the past.
Interesting.
And he will answer that question. Yeah. So it was really fascinating because you can read about it, you can watch a video, but there's nothing who pays the value of it. It's almost like a face-to-face conversation, right? So that's just to give you a little tidbit, a sidebar example. And then when you go into the real conversations, there were over 400 sessions. I can tell you from the sessions, from many of the sessions, technology has dominated conversation. Everything from the public sector to private sector, you know, Jack Ma talk about AI, talk about e-commerce or digital trade, which is what I do, and I understand what I'll be talking about. You know, one quote I always remember, he said that in the future of trade is not containers, but small parcels from e-commerce. Mm. Right. And that's really interesting. And then Google's CEO Pichai said that AI is more important than fire to human society, to the human, to our society.
So these are big statements from very important people. These are really speaking to and pointing to the hope and promise of technology versus the threat that it might create for us. So you would say, all in all, it was a positive spin on the role that technology has to play in the development of global economics.
I think overall, or even if there are challenges, then, you know, I think the overall consensus, at least from what I think, is trying to take the challenges and make that into opportunities.
I'm Steve Stein, and this is Inside Asia. I'm speaking with Ziyang Feng, former senior legal counsel at Airbnb in Asia, and now project head of digital trade and cross-border data flows at the Center for the Fourth Industrial Revolution. Cross-border digital trade is one of the fastest growing aspects of commerce today. We're talking something in the realm of $2.3 trillion B2C and $17 trillion in B2B transactions. That's still only about 12% of total global trade, but it's growing at a rate of 25%+ per annum. It's an issue that's starting to raise eyebrows in countries around the world who worry that the big digital players might be taking revenue away from their markets and not paying their fair share of tax. Airbnb, Netflix, and others deal with this issue day to day as they look to penetrate global markets. I asked Ziyang to share his thoughts on the subject.
Yeah, as you mentioned, the digital trade is growing at a very fast pace. If you look at the cross-border data flows, it increased 45 times in the past 10 years, and it's going to increase another 9 times in the next 5 years. And this is, I mean, Steve, we have to think, you realize, we're just really at a cusp of it. IoT, right? It's when we have more and more IoT devices connected, when the cars, which are become IoT devices, the amount of data they're going to generate is just going to be really mind-boggling. So back to your questions, and it's, and some of the digital trade services and platforms are also become more and more ubiquitous around the world. I think that's the challenges of policy making and the technology, is that we have to find solutions. The old way of policy making may not be the best way. For example, I work in the government, and you're familiar with the policy making as well. It takes a long time, right? It takes a long time.
Yeah, it does.
So it doesn't matter which system, which government system you work in, it takes a long time. You need to study the issue, you need to draft it, then in the Parliament or Congress or State Council, then discuss it, go come down again, draft it again, you know. By the time, it may work in the past, but nowadays when you follow the same model, if you draft it, policy regulation for technology X, by the time that draft or policy is issued, the technology has evolved and has moved on.
So that's the problem. How do we address that, Ziyang? How do you actually then keep pace with the technological changes, or do you not? Do you basically just defer to the possibility or the likelihood that technology is going to be going through a multiplier effect and policy will never be able to keep pace? Where do you go with that?
Steve, that's a gazillion dollar question. So, me and you, but we'll take a crack at it. I think what we need now is called agile governance, and that's something in a multi-stakeholder process, and that's something that we at the center is trying to do, and that's something I really believe in, is that the public sector and the private sector need to work together. We've heard about that for so many years now, have to work together. But I think
yes,
with technology, it's absolutely critical. Because for the private sector to provide input and help the public sector to issue policy and regulations, and for the public sector to get expertise from the private sector and really understand the implications of technology, Because I think the interests of both sectors are aligned is really that with the fast pace of technology, we really have to come up with a more agile, more faster pace of governance. And I said governance, not necessarily government. I think it's more includes government policy regulations, but it's more than that. It could include industry standards or protocols. I think the whole society needs to be engaged on those issues.
You know, is there a bit of an issue with and being there in Silicon Valley? Do you feel like there's a bit of a challenge being posed by technology companies that are now being perceived by governments as actually predatory or overly aggressive, or not sharing in data or information sufficient to help people manage their economies or manage their populations? I mean, of course, there's the political side where, you know, Twitter and social media has given license to revolutions, you know, in the Middle East, the Arab Spring, for instance. But then we've also got these, and which can be seen as a threat. But then at the same time, you know, there is this wonderful opportunity if governments start to cooperate and coordinate. For instance, the ASEAN blocs of the seven countries, where if they coordinate their activities, they can actually optimize use of technology and really look to data flows in a way of perpetuating their economies, both individually and collectively. What do you think?
Again, excellent point. Just to piggyback on the ASEAN issue, I think, you know, with digital trade, with the data flows, there are, I can definitely see the perspective from both sides, right? From the government, there is a need for protecting data privacy, data security, or what if there's a terrorism using this platform, how do we know that, or using platforms to send messages. So a lot of very much legitimate concerns. On the other hand, for the companies, they need to allow data to flow between countries or among countries, you know, so they can provide the best services to their customers and also to guard their customers' data privacy as well. So I think there's definitely a lot of room for cooperation. But the first is really for two sides to understand each other. I think what happens in some countries is that because the government maybe don't have a quite full understanding, they tend to have a sometimes a knee-jerk reaction and come down with a much harsher regulation than it is necessary. You know, as a lawyer, you know, nothing is black and white. It's never yes and no. There's always room to dissect and compartmentalize and find a compromise. So I think that's really the key. For example, with data, if the country is just because of data privacy security reasons, just say, you know, no data can leave the country or data have to be localized, for example, you know, is that really the best way to deal with the issue that, you know, that remains to be seen. Like, how does that help your innovative economy, for example? So I think especially in the ASEAN region, because the countries are relatively small, that's another thing I want to mention is that for ASEAN, in order for ASEAN countries and companies to compete, I mean, they have to compete with the FANGs and bats, right? They have the Googles, the Facebooks, the Amazons in the U.S., and the Baidu, Alibaba, and Tencent of China. But those companies have scale. They have scale domestically and they have scale internationally. And for ASEAN countries, they are relatively small in market size to start with, and if they divide themselves up and not unite together, it will be even more difficult for companies and countries to compete with the giant tech giant.
Ziyang, do you feel that maybe some of the ASEAN countries are looking to the China example, where it actually protected its burgeoning internet companies, provided kind of time and space for the Alibabas and the Baidus and the Tencents of the world to build and grow and leverage that domestic market before they went global? Are they now looking and saying, perhaps we should have done the same? So is there a wave of digital protectionism which is creeping into these ASEAN economies?
I think the protectionism is not just in ASEAN, it's not just in tech, I mean, around the world, there's just been this backlash against globalization, as you know, and protectionism trend is growing all over the world, even where I'm sitting right now in the U.S., as everyone knows. However, I think for ASEAN countries, there's also a realization that there are a lot of opportunities. For, I think one of the most successful examples from ASEAN is Grab, right? Grab has done a fantastic job.
That's Grab, which is the taxi service, right? This is for some people who don't know it. Yeah, it's basically applying a digital solution to an existing taxi fleet as opposed to an Uber, which is really more kind of a from the ground up business model.
Yeah, exactly. They have adopted the technology well for the region, and they were able to keep tech giants like Uber at bay in ASEAN, or some of the e-commerce companies. For example, I know Lazada, based in Singapore, has also done a really good job of working with the stakeholders and customers in ASEAN region. So I think those are, and Lazada is based in Singapore, you know, which has a fairly open data policy. So I think those are some of the examples that not necessarily, I think there should be the, those are good examples that the protectionism are not necessarily the best way, because when you protect, yeah, you should protect your own companies, but you also keep out other, you also prevent your companies to venture into other markets as well, right?
Well, then there's,
so I think, you know, that's an issue.
Well, then there's also the issue of tax revenue. And there's a couple of examples. And you know, there's this love-hate relationship between some of the governments around in Asia and Ubers and the Netflix and the others and the Amazons that are generating, allowing access to their service. Transactions are occurring. And then the revenue is flowing primarily to the service organizations. Let's talk about Netflix. I mean, media is already a sensitive subject in many markets anyway. Censorship is in place in many places and continues to be an issue. But even then, if you have subscribers in Indonesia, for instance, who are subscribing to Netflix, paying globally, but then the government, as those services are rolling out, they're perhaps reducing the number of subscribers that might be viewing pay TV or cable TV services. So the government is a bit concerned that they're losing revenue. The market is losing access to tax revenue. What do we do about that? And what's fair?
That's another very interesting and important issue. And back to Davos. To exactly on that issue, Google CEO said, we're happy to pay more tax.
As a statement of principle. In other words, share the revenue in a more thoughtful fashion. Is it that they haven't to date because the systems aren't in place to support it or to track it? I mean, it's data. So after all, they will know where their subscriber base is, how much revenue is being generated, and they should be able to give something back. But so far, they're resisting it because there are no laws governing it. Would that be accurate?
Yeah, I think that's the point, is that for tech companies, there's a more ongoing realization that, you know, as which I said, that they're willing to pay more tax, but the system is not in place to support it. You know, it's not about, you know, how much tax companies pay, but for example, how you divide that among various countries, right? How do you do it by per customer, per subscription? It's a complicated issue. I think that's why it's not just a simple, if you pay tax, otherwise we're going to ban you from operating in the country. So that is not the way to engage. And that's why I think important conversations need to happen between the public and private sectors to really come up with a new system for this constantly evolving world.
Ziyang, will these be bilateral agreements that companies, global companies, have with specific governments, or is there room or an opportunity for a multilateral or a global agreement where, you know, revenue sharing is set and established at a universal basis?
Steve, I would hope, and I think it will probably be the latter. To give you an example with multilateral. For example, in e-commerce, you know, the trade agreements, if you look, just looking at the bilateral trade agreements between two countries, yes, that means if you're one country, you have to sign what, maybe 170 different trade agreements with bilateral, whereas if you join the WTO, right, and you only have to sign one accession agreement that you can join other benefits. So that model has worked in the past, and it should work in the future. However, the challenge is that to really bring the stakeholders together. And then again, that's what the forum, the World Economic Forum, does, is to launch this multi-stakeholder dialogue between the private sector, don't forget civil society, very, very important, and also academia, that the four pillars that bring everyone together, have the conversation, and to really discuss those important issues.
This is Inside Asia, and that was my conversation with Ziyang Feng, former senior legal counsel at Airbnb in Asia, and now project head of digital trade and cross-border data flows at the Center for the Fourth Industrial Revolution. Thanks for listening. As listeners know, each of our episodes ends with an insider minute where I offer a few thoughts on the conversation you've just heard. More often than not, it's a question I land on rather than a conclusion. And that's all right. Maybe it's for the best. Better to know what you don't know than what you do. Here's what we do know. Digital disruption is everywhere. No sector has gone untouched, and the pace of change has governments, corporations, and policymakers in a tailspin. It's not surprising that few can keep up with all this cataclysmic change. Governments may be the most disadvantaged, not because they aren't aware of the issues and challenges, but because lawmaking is an arduous affair. The public sector, by design, some might say, has a metabolism that can only seem glacial to those who inhabit the leaner, sometimes meaner, private sphere. But this is different. Something else is happening. Capital is flowing in complex and potentially untraceable directions. Armed with a credit card or PayPal account, individuals and enterprises have a world of commerce at their fingertips. Now layer in cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin or Ethereum, and the rules of trade become fuzzier. If cryptocurrencies are universal, by definition, national currencies become obsolete. The banking industry, as we know it, is no more. Why is this an issue for governments? Because the banking establishment has long served as the backbone for verifying, moving, and tracking financial transactions, and then providing governments with the data they need to apply taxes and tariffs. Some herald this as a moment of individual financial liberalization, the ultimate cutting out of the middleman and a move in the direction of the purest form of free trade. Others point out that to bypass a system that for so long has secured commerce means surrendering to the possibility of fraud and global economic instability. Innovation thrives in a realm of law and order. If governments are disintermediated, who then ensures the rule of law? Ziyang reminds us that we can only keep this ground of innovation intact through increasingly sophisticated forms of public-private initiatives. Only together, he argues, can the critical issues be brought to light where ordinary people can see them clearly and understand all that's at stake. It's not going to be easy, but it needs to happen, and happen soon. Only by grasping the importance of these shared interests and putting aside legacy suspicions will public and private sectors be able to ensure the future of a global capitalist system underpinned by free, fair, and legal trade. Governments can't do it alone, but they just might with a little help from their friends. If you like what you're hearing, visit us at www.insideasiapodcast.com. Sign up for our newsletter and download any or all of our 40 episodes. Until next time, this is Steve Stein saying, come in from the outside on Inside Asia.